A blizzard. A body. A silence louder than screams. In the quiet town of Norcaster, Massachusetts, a decorated police officer is found dead in the snow. No footprints, no witnesses, no answers. His girlfriend, Alyssa Grant, becomes the prime suspect overnight. But what begins as an open and shut case quickly unravels into something far darker. Hidden evidence, tampered surveillance, offshore accounts, and a brotherhood of lawmen who will do anything to protect their secrets. This is not just a murder trial. It's a system on trial. Told from the woman at the heart of the storm, The Body in the Snow, A Shadows of Justice Case Unveiled, is a raw, intimate true crime audiobook where red tape cuts deeper than knives, and justice is a game rigged from the start. If you think you know how the story ends, you haven't stepped into the snow yet. Blizzard of Silence. The storm had already swallowed the town when I left the house. Everything was white. The sky, the street, my breath. The kind of cold that sinks into your teeth and turns sound into something distant and broken. And yet, all I could hear was my own heartbeat. Even then, it didn't sound like mine. They say blizzards bring silence. But I remember that night being full of noise, internal noise, the static in my mind from the fight. The slam of the car door, Daniel's voice, sharp like cracked glass, the weight of unspoken things between us. He was angry. I was angrier. But neither of us deserved what happened next. By morning, the plow driver found him, Daniel Kearns, Boston PD, decorated, dead, his body face down in the snow like he'd just stopped, frozen, no footprints, no blood trail. Just a man in a navy jacket and badge, blanketed by snow in Norcaster's quietest cul-de-sac. They say I left him there. They say I ran him over. They say I drank too much and lost control. But they didn't ask what I saw when I left him at that party. They didn't ask about Sergeant Nolan's house, the way Daniel hesitated on the doorstep, or how the lights were off, even though there were cars parked outside. They didn't ask what Daniel whispered to me before he got out. Don't follow me in. Not this time. And I remember the next morning like a smear. The banging on my door. The blue and red lights bouncing off the icicles on my porch. The cuffs on my wrist before I even understood why they were there. They showed me pictures. His body. The cracked taillight on my SUV. Said I confessed at the station, though I remember none of it. They say a lot of things. And just like that, I was no longer Alyssa Grant, girlfriend. I became Alyssa Grant, suspect. I didn't know then that I was walking into a nightmare stitched together by red tape, buried under decades of silence, and rigged by people who wore justice like a badge, while rotting beneath it. The town of Norcaster had always looked clean on the surface, but under snow, you don't see the blood. They told me it was an open and shut case, but no one explained why the surveillance cameras at Nolan's house were disabled, why Daniel's autopsy didn't match the narrative, why his phone pinged miles away long after I was home asleep. It wasn't just grief that burned in my chest, it was suspicion. And soon, suspicion became obsession, because what they wanted was to bury more than just Daniel. They wanted to bury the truth. What happened next turned a grieving woman into a pariah, and a quiet New England town into the epicenter of one of the most sinister cases the media would ever latch onto. It didn't take long for my life to unravel, shredded by whispers, headlines, and social media sleuths. Even the true crime bookstagram girls got their piece, framing me like a character in a murder mystery. But this wasn't fiction. This was my life, and it was just getting started. The confession trap. They didn't question me. They scripted me. By the time I sat in that gray-walled interrogation room, the narrative had already been decided. A drunken girlfriend, a jealous rage, a deadly accident turned cover-up. But what they really wanted was a confession to wrap the whole thing in a bow. And they almost got it. I sat there for 6 hours. My lips were cracked from the cold. My eyes swollen from crying. I'd been pulled from my bed. No lawyer, no food, no phone call. Just two detectives and a printed theory that didn't match the night I lived through. They slid photos across the table. Daniel's lifeless body, my SUV's shattered taillight, a broken cocktail glass found nearby. Then they said the words that made the walls shrink. "Alyssa, just tell us what happened. We already know. You dropped him off. You circled back. You hit him." I blinked. My throat locked. "You don't remember because you were drunk. But deep down, you know." The lie was dressed as concern. They called it helping me remember. But it wasn't memory. It was mental manipulation. And somewhere in the middle of that fog, I muttered something. I said I was sorry. I said I didn't mean to hurt him. I was talking about the fight. But that wasn't how it was recorded. That sentence, wrapped in exhaustion and grief, would become the core of the prosecution's case. They called it a confession. I called it a trap. Later, I found out the room's recording system had technical issues that night. They said the mic cut in and out, the tape skipped, but the part they kept, the part they transcribed, conveniently intact. I asked for the full footage. They said it was corrupted. I asked to see the original documents. They said red tape delayed it. And just like that, I became a woman snared in a system that feeds on shortcuts and shadows, where bureaucracy isn't a neutral structure, it's a weapon. My lawyer, a bulldog named Trina Leary, came in swinging. She asked questions the police didn't like. Who collected the broken glass? Why weren't the partygoers questioned on record? Why was Sergeant Nolan, the host of the house Daniel entered that night, allowed to supervise the early investigation? The answer to everything? It's internal protocol. Another word for cover-up. Then Trina did something that cracked the case wide open. She requested Daniel's banking records, a long shot. But what came back wasn't a gambling problem or financial stress. It was worse. Offshore accounts, multiple, linked to Sergeant Nolan's name. Suddenly, this wasn't about a drunken hit and run anymore. This was about something bigger. Daniel knew something, and that something might have gotten him killed. I started getting messages from an anonymous number. Photos of Daniel from that night I hadn't seen. Blurry shots of him arguing in Nolan's driveway. One image showed him clutching a manila envelope. What was in it? Why did he bring it to that house? Why didn't he make it out? The answers were out there, but every step closer pulled me deeper into a nest of lies, loyalty, and financial corruption so tightly woven into Norcaster's power structure that it would take more than truth to bring it down. It would take destruction. They thought they had their story, but they forgot something important. I'm still here, and I'm still talking. Echoes from Nolan's house. Sergeant Nolan's house still stood like a mausoleum. Clean lawn, white shutters, a flag out front. Perfect, untouchable. But to me, it became the epicenter of everything I couldn't unsee. The place where Daniel walked in and never came back out. He was supposed to be at a party. Just another off-duty cop get-together. The kind of gathering where everyone in that room already knew the outcome, even before the body hit the snow. I remembered the way Daniel looked at the door that night. Like it wasn't just a house, but a threshold. He was holding something close to his chest, physically, emotionally, something I wasn't supposed to see, and he told me not to come inside. Now I know why. Trina subpoenaed the security system files. But guess what? The cameras, every single one, were offline due to maintenance. One officer testified the hard drives were overwritten automatically. Automatic. Convenient. Scripted. They called it technical failure. I call it premeditation. One of Daniel's friends, Officer Caleb Drayton, agreed to talk, off the record. We met in a frozen Dunkin' parking lot. He didn't look at me when he spoke. Just stared into his black coffee like it held absolution. Daniel found something. Alyssa, it wasn't just about Nolan. There were others, high up. Not just dirty money, financial crimes, bribes, payout pipelines. Some of it went through offshore accounts. Some of it funneled back through a local nonprofit run by a city councilman. "You're not just dealing with a murder case," he whispered. "You're sitting on a landmine." I didn't sleep that night. I started pulling threads, donation records, real estate transfers, travel itineraries. Trina's contacts helped trace some wire transfers that led right back to shell corporations in the Cayman Islands, under names I couldn't pronounce, but traced to people I'd shaken hands with at fundraisers. This wasn't just corruption. It was a network, and Daniel had tried to blow the whistle, the morning after Caleb's warning, his apartment burned down. Electrical fire, they said. But I don't believe in coincidence anymore. I went back to Nolan's house in daylight, parked across the street. I sat and stared, replaying everything Daniel said the night he vanished into those walls. And then I saw something. A figure in the window, curtains shifting, a face I couldn't place. Not Nolan. Younger, a girl. Later, a local teenager named Marley posted a TikTok outside the same house. She'd been walking her dog when she heard screaming from inside Nolan's garage the night Daniel died. But her video disappeared. Her account vanished. I found her, asked her what she heard. She looked at me with hollow eyes. A man yelling. A thud. Then silence. Then nothing but the snow. Huh, she wouldn't speak after that. Her dad's a cop. They were erasing witnesses, smearing the timeline, fabricating noise in a town that prided itself on its silence. But I wasn't staying quiet. This wasn't just about Daniel's body anymore. It was about what he carried into that house. The evidence. The truth. And I had to find it before they buried it for good. Because the closer I got to Nolan's secrets, the louder the echoes became. Evidence buried in bureaucracy. I used to believe paperwork protected people. You know, contracts, forms, policies, signatures, a trail of accountability. But I was wrong. Paper doesn't protect truth. It suffocates it. In Norcaster, justice wasn't denied outright. It was buried in paperwork so deep, you'd choke trying to pull it out. The search warrant for Nolan's house? Delayed due to procedural review. The autopsy addendum that showed blunt trauma inconsistent with a car strike? Flagged for internal medical audit. Daniel's text messages from the night of his death. Under legal suppression pending privacy review, every time Trina filed a motion, we got back nothing but bureaucratic smokescreens. Stamp after stamp of legal red tape, piled up by people who knew how to hide in plain sight. But one person inside the system didn't want to be part of it anymore. Her name was Leanne. She worked in the evidence room. Civilian support staff, mid-30s, meticulous. Trina had gone to high school with her, and somehow, Leanne agreed to meet us at a diner just off Route 6. She sat across from me, nervously stirring her tea. "They logged the glass from the scene as a match to your SUV," she said. "But that's not what the test actually showed. It was tempered safety glass, yeah, but not the same composition. And the damage pattern didn't match a taillight impact. So why did the report say it was yours?" I asked. She didn't answer, just tapped her nails against the Form 62 clearance badge hanging around her neck. "Because once it's signed off upstairs, it's final." Leanne passed me a flash drive. On it, internal memos, test results, emails. One from Sergeant Nolan's private account. He referred to me as a liability, and Daniel as the weak link. There it was. Intent. Not proof of murder, but proof of motive, proof of control, proof that they saw Daniel's whistleblowing as a threat, not just to the department, but to their financial scaffolding. Trina tried to admit the documents into court, but the judge, a lifelong friend of Nolan's, called the flash drive inadmissible, said it was obtained outside the chain of custody, told the jury to disregard. Like justice could be turned on and off by protocol. Like truth was only valid if approved by process. Meanwhile, the DA leaked my psych records. The media ran with it. She had a history of anxiety. She was known to overreact. Daniel had mentioned she was unstable. None of it was true. But the headlines stuck. And in Norcaster, perception was everything. I went from suspect to villain. From grieving woman to killer girlfriend. They made me infamous without ever proving a thing. I stopped answering my phone. People sent death threats. My job put me on indefinite leave. The Bookstagram pages used my face on mock-up thriller covers. One TikToker made a whole Justice Tales video series, painting me as a femme fatale who snapped. They called me the Ice Queen. They didn't know I cried every night until my chest physically hurt. They didn't know I still slept in Daniel's hoodie. But the worst part? Even as the lies piled up, part of me still hoped I was wrong, that this was just grief. A tragic accident, something explainable, because if I wasn't wrong, then they killed him. And I was next. That's when I found Daniel's backup email account, the one under an alias, inside a draft folder filled with everything he was building, spreadsheets of fund transfers, anonymous donor logs, a letter to an internal affairs officer, and one unsent email. It read, "If I disappear, check the Nolan files, the real ones, the ones in the locked cabinet behind the bar. Tell Alyssa I'm sorry for dragging her into this, but it has to end." My hands shook, because in that moment, I knew one thing for certain. This was never about a car crash. This was a cover-up with fingerprints in every file drawer, every courtroom bench, every badge on the wall, and I wasn't backing down. The media knife. The truth can be your weapon, but in the wrong hands, it becomes a scalpel, used not to heal, but to cut you open and leave you bleeding in public. That's what the media did to me. It started with a headline, "Girlfriend or Grim Reaper?" Inside the icy case of Alyssa Grant. Then came the segments. Local, national, podcasters, YouTubers, TikTokers. The same photo of me, taken mid-blink, pale, hollowed out by grief, was used again and again. They paired it with slanted scripts, sinister piano music, and phrases like, "No signs of a break-in, no other suspects, all signs point to her." They quoted the prosecution word for word, but framed it like investigative journalism. On Instagram, I was turned into a hashtag. Justice for Danny. Shadows of justice. So the body in the snow. There were entire Bookstagram threads turning my case into true crime aesthetic, pairing photos of snowy streets with murder-themed candles and quotes like, "Monsters wear makeup too." They didn't know me. But they hated me. Some of them even loved hating me. It gave them a rush, made them feel like they were solving a puzzle, when all they were doing was spreading someone else's lies. One morning I woke up to find that someone had made a Reddit thread dissecting my body language in the courtroom. They zoomed in on my crossed arms, my posture, my lack of tears. "Classic narcissist," someone commented. "Her performance is off," said another. "She flinches when they show Daniel's face. Guilty for sure." Meanwhile, no one questioned the cops, not the failure to log the internal timeline, not the destroyed surveillance drives, not the fact that the very man whose house Daniel disappeared into, Sergeant Nolan, was allowed to testify as a character witness against me. Trina tried to submit the leaked internal financial documents again. Rejected. She asked for a mistrial based on prosecutorial misconduct. Denied. She filed an emergency motion to have an independent examiner retest the so-called taillight glass. Blocked. We were bleeding out in court, and public opinion was the knife. Then something unexpected happened. A junior producer from a major podcast, Sinister Cases Unveiled, reached out to me directly. Her name was Lily Marston, young, sharp, and unlike the rest of the vultures, she wasn't interested in clicks. She was interested in patterns. Lily had been tracking corrupt financial dealings across small-town law enforcement units, and Norcaster's numbers, especially the offshore donations to the town's police auxiliary fund, had raised her eyebrows. "This isn't just about Daniel," she told me. "This is a template. Your story fits a string of others. Whistleblowers in small precincts getting silenced. Cases spun to protect those in power. I think you're part of a bigger map." We worked in secret. Lily had sources I didn't. She got me internal files. A voicemail from a precinct informant warning about Nolan's reach. Even financial scam links from a Boston-based nonprofit connected to three cops now on medical leave. It was bigger than I ever imagined. And now, it was finally getting attention. But Lily warned me, when truth starts to bleed out in public, the system fights harder to cauterize it. She was right. My apartment was broken into a week later. Just my laptop was taken. Nothing else touched. That same day, the DA filed a motion to bar all media presence for the remainder of the trial, citing witness intimidation. But the storm had already started. Public opinion began to shift. TikTokers reversed their stance. Bookstagram pages apologized. Safium. Shadows of Justice started trending, for me this time. People wanted answers, and they weren't accepting the sanitized version anymore. I was no longer alone, and the people who built this lie, they were starting to feel the heat. Shadows of Justice. The courtroom smelled like wood polish and dust, not justice. It never did. By the time we reached closing arguments, I'd stopped trying to prove I was innocent. Now I just wanted people to admit that something was wrong. That this wasn't just about a woman and a man in a driveway, but about a whole system built on shadows. The prosecution's case had begun to unravel. Not in a dramatic, Hollywood way, but slowly, like a sweater snagged on a nail, one thread at a time. First, a civilian forensic analyst came forward, not someone from our side, an internal technician who'd worked with the state lab. He testified, reluctantly, that Daniel's injuries were not consistent with a vehicle strike. There's no undercarriage trauma, no spinal compression, no tire tracks. He paused before continuing. It looks more like he was struck by something, smaller, handheld, blunt. The jury shifted. So did the silence in the room. Then came the leaked internal texts, messages between Nolan and another officer, joking about cleaning up loose ends the night Daniel died. When Trina read them aloud, I watched the prosecutor flinch. Just for a second, but enough. The star witness, a neighbor who claimed to have seen my SUV near the house that night, broke on the stand. She admitted she had been pressured to change her statement. She'd originally told officers she couldn't make out the vehicle in the snow. But after a follow-up visit by Nolan's team, she remembered it clearly. The judge's face turned pale. The jurors, they were starting to connect the dots. Still, no one said the words. No one called it what it was. A frame job. A takedown. A cover-up. Because admitting that would mean dragging the whole town under with it. Lily Marston's podcast dropped mid-trial. Over 3 million downloads in a week. The Body in the Snow, The Real Story. Featuring interviews, financial records, even clips from Daniel's backup email drafts. It forced the national media to cover the case with more caution, forced the DA's office to fumble their narrative, forced the jury to wonder if they lied about this, what else? And then, finally, DNA evidence found on Daniel's jacket, not mine, not Nolan's, but someone else's, someone from inside that house. They never released the name publicly, but everyone in that courtroom knew. The verdict? Not guilty. No cheers. No tears. Just a deep, cold silence that settled into my bones. Not because I was free, but because no one else would ever be held responsible. Nolan was never charged. The malfunctions were never investigated. The offshore accounts, labeled as unrelated to Daniel's death, the shadow remained. I walked out of that courtroom a free woman in legal terms, but chained to a truth no one wanted to face. People still whisper when they see me. Some think I got away with murder. Some know I survived one. Most just want to forget. But I won't, because Daniel didn't die in the snow. He was killed in a house full of people wearing uniforms. People who'd built a system to protect themselves, not the truth. And when that system couldn't hold the weight of Daniel's conscience, it snapped his spine instead. There are still nights I wake up freezing, dreaming I see his body again, dreaming I hear his voice, dreaming I followed him inside the house and stopped it all. But I didn't. This isn't just a true crime story. It's a justice tale written in frostbite and fear. It's a warning, because in places like Norcaster, justice isn't blind, it's bought. And if you try to shine a light into the shadows, you better be ready for what's staring back.